Who here has had their heart broken? Yeah, most of us could raise our hands a couple times. Who here has been betrayed in a way too painful to ever forget? Had a marble jar friend who one day just walked off with all the marbles, and you never connected in the same way with that person or with those people or people who looked like them? Who here has lost trust? And maybe not just with one person, but with groups of people, and not just once, but for a long time. And we're left feeling a little lost and a little disillusioned. Who here has at one time or another switched from trust to cynicism because it's easier? And maybe the circumstance deserved it, but then later when you wanted to switch back into openness and wholeheartedness, found it tough to make that switch. And despite promising yourself that you wouldn't end up being that jaded or guarded person that you've seen in your life, and you said you never wanted to be like them, it's still hard to breach that distance of living with life at arm's length. The truth is, we've all been there. And not just us here and now, but people everywhere and for a long time. Listen to this poem by 14th century Persian poet Hafez. What do sad people have in common? It seems they have all built a shrine to the past, to all the hurts and betrayals they've known. And they often go there and cry in a strange, wailing way that becomes the way they worship, as though religiously wailing will somehow protect them from ever being hurt again. What is the beginning of happiness? It is to stop being so religious like that. Oops. Take a look at this picture. Now think about it without saying anything. How many people see a face? How many people see a word? If I turn it on, if I turn the face on its face, how many people see a word? How many people still have situations in their lives where they can't help but see the word even when they're looking at someone's face? It can happen when we look at the world. It can happen when we look at other people. It can sometimes even happen when we look in the mirror. Changing that, relearning how to trust and love the world again after being hurt is work, spiritual work, sometimes a lifetime's worth of work. I want to tell you this morning about one of my heroes who has taught me a lot about this. As a man by the name of Thomas Merton. Some of you may know him, have read some stuff by him. You may know him as one of the world's most popular monks, sort of like a super monk of the 20th century. The reason I admire him is not really because of his theology or his holiness. It was because as I read about him, I understood how he struggled so much to understand and accept his own pain and the pain of the others in his life with whom he had conflicts, who had broken his heart. Merton was born to an American mother and a New Zealand father, two artists who met in Paris who were a little bit narcissistic and not necessarily as into being parents as they were into leading parts of their lives. And his mother died of cancer when Thomas was six. He was sent to a boarding school in France and then another one later in England, and he felt a little bit betrayed and abandoned by his father for not taking closer care of him. And when his father died of a brain tumor when he was 15, Merton struggled for something he really could believe in and trust. He eventually enrolled in Cambridge University as an aspiring writer. And stories that describe his dismissal from Cambridge include reports about someone getting pregnant or being cast out by the woman's family and certainly being cast out by the school. None of it's necessarily confirmed, but all of it reveals a certain amount of pain. Disillusioned and alone, Thomas Merton retreated into himself, and he turned to religion for its sense of order and discipline. And first, he was interested in becoming a Franciscan, but when they found out that he had an illegitimate child, they rejected him. So he ended up becoming a Trappist monk. Anybody who knows anything about the Trappist monks knows that it's one of the strictest and most demanding of religious orders. It's sort of like the Marine Corps of religious orders. As a Trappist monk, he was forbidden contact with the outside world at all, but Merton discovered how we can encounter range anxiety, as Jennifer puts it, even when retreating from the world into ourselves. The Trappist order he belonged to in Louisville, Kentucky, assigned him to write mostly monastic history and history of the saints, but Thomas Merton was unconventional, one of the things that made him really interesting and great, and he began to understand that human beings were made to be in relationship. And even though it was against orders, he secretly began having correspondence with the likes of the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh and Pope John Paul XXIII and Martin Luther King Jr. on issues of war and racism and women's rights and the environment. He helped to shape a lot of what came out of some very dark conversations and bring some light into those moments and help people move from conflict and feelings of personal and existential betrayal to a sense of connection. Several of the books and collections of letters were published, and Merton became very well known. He became sort of like a rock star among monks, if there is such thing. But no one knew what he looked like. And to make matters worse, everyone at the Abbey in Louisville referred to him as Father Louis. So sometimes he would lead tours, and he found that people would come on pilgrimages to visit him and meet the man who had written so many great things. And they would come, and he would lead the tour, and the people would always ask, "Can you show me where Thomas Merton lives and where he writes?" And he would always say, "What do you want to see him for? He's not so great. He's not nearly as holy as people think he is." In his writings, Merton described himself as a man whose only attempts at relationship ended disastrously. But that retreat from conflicts and from complicated feelings and relationships was not what would gain him peace. The story of his epiphany came while running errands for the monastery in downtown Louisville, Kentucky. And those who are going to General Assembly this year in Louisville have a chance to go to the corner of 4th and Walnut and read a little bit about what his epiphany was. I will read to you what he said occurred to him there from his memoir, Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander. He says, "In Louisville, at the corner of 4th and Walnut, in the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all these people, that despite their heartbreak and mine, that we could not be alien to one another, even though we were really total strangers. It was like waking from a dream of separateness, of spurious self-isolation in a special world. This sense of liberation from an illusion of difference was such a relief and such a joy to me that I almost laughed out loud, as if the sorrows and stupidities of the human condition could overwhelm me. But now I realize there is not one Savior, but we're all possible saviors to each other. If only everyone could realize this. But it cannot be explained. There is no way of telling people that they are all walking around shining like the sun. It was as if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts, the depths of their souls, where neither sin nor desire nor self-loathing can reach. The core of their reality, the person that each one is in God's eyes. If only they could all see themselves as they really are. If only we could see each other that way all the time. We started out this morning with the song "Tu La Clizeo." The song, some of you may know, was written by Joseph Shambalala. Joseph, that's the plaque at 4th and Walnut in downtown Louisville. Joseph Shambalala is the lead singer of the African singing group Ladysmith Black Mambazo. This group was famous throughout Africa from the late 1950s to the 1980s, and they formed a group to enter competition with other groups to sing traditional songs about their homeland at festivals, and they invoked the spirit of the land expressed in the people's voices, people who had felt very alienated and had been pushed out by the government and suppressed in the way that they sang. After a few years, they were banned from competition because they were too good, as they say. They won almost every competition they entered, and they discouraged others from entering, so they decided to step aside. Ladysmith Black Mambazo became an important voice during the years of apartheid, a time of great civil unrest to the people of Africa, and they became a source of spiritual illumination during a time of deep human and cultural conflict. In the early 1980s, Paul Simon fell in love with the music of Ladysmith Black Mambazo and made two albums with them that catapulted them onto the world stage. And it led to a tour which took the entire group out of their homeland in South Africa and took them all over the world. For some in the group, it was the first time out of their country. And for most of them, it was the first time off of their continent. And at a time when the forces behind apartheid were threatening and cracking down on the life that they led there. Well, while traveling in New York City, Joseph Shambalala got the news that because of the violence and instability of his country of South Africa, that the country was closing its borders. And he realized this meant that he might never be able to go home again. And if he did go home, it would be radically different. His children might not be there. His family may be relocated. He felt betrayed by his country. He felt guilty for leaving, and he felt terribly homesick. And it was in a cab, looking out at all of the people walking around in New York City, that he came up with the words, "Tu La Clizeo, be still my heart. Nala Pasakaya, even here you are at home. Be still my heart, even here you are at home." None of us is immune to the hurts and betrayals of this world, and very few, if any, are ever saved by shutting our eyes and retreating into doubt and despair. It's in the hardest moments, in the darkest times, we are sometimes made aware of how we shine and how people around us shine, even when circumstance dim our countenance. The people and the things that sometimes frighten us the most are not unfamiliar to our feelings of pain and betrayal. And it may take being able to live with imagination and creativity, to live with our eyes wide shut, as Thomas Merton sometimes said, to discover that people everywhere are walking around shining like the sun. In this world so set in retreat mode, running away from what scares us only leads to more darkness. Sometimes we need to hold our own tenderness against the turmoil of the world and say, "Be still, my heart. Even here, you are at home." Tula klizeo, nala pasakaya. Be still, my heart. Even here, you are at home. Let's try to sing that one more time. And sing it as though somebody depended on us to remind them that they, even in their darkness, are shining like the sun.